This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka. The first reported case of COVID-19 variant first found in the United Kingdom has now been discovered in the U.S. state of Colorado. Governor Jared Polis and state health officials announced Tuesday that the case was found in a man in his 20s who's in isolation and has no travel history. British scientists believe the new virus variant is more contagious than previously identified strains. Colorado health officials say the new vaccines against the virus are believed to be effective against the variant. Public health officials are investigating other potential cases and doing contact tracing to determine the variant's spread in the state. President Donald Trump's push for large pandemic relief checks to struggling Americans stalled out on Tuesday. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked a vote on the matter proposed by Democrats. Republican senators appear split over new spending. The Republican leader signaled an alternative approach, linking President Trump's demand for aid with restrictions the president wants on tech companies. McConnell says the Senate will begin a process to address the issues, but the next steps are highly uncertain. The House approved the larger checks. The Canadian province of Quebec is urging the federal government to require COVID-19 testing for residents who return from a year-end vacation. The request comes after images of maskless tourists spending time at overseas beaches hit social media as cases rose. Canada's travel restrictions are among the world's toughest, with non-essential foreigners normally denied entry and citizens returning from abroad mandated to quarantine. This is VOA News. The U.S. Acting Attorney General said Tuesday the country is ready to try a militant convicted of murdering American journalist Daniel Pearl in 2002. This comes after a Pakistani court ordered the militant's release. The decision by Sindh High Court to release the accused comes months after it sparked outrage for overturning the murder conviction and death sentence of Ahmed Omer Saeed Sheikh. The court also acquitted three other men connected to the case. The four are being held under the emergency orders of the local government, while an ongoing appeal against their acquittals is heard in the Supreme Court. Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen said the U.S. stands ready to take custody of Omar Sheikh. The European Union and United States criticized the jailing of a citizen journalist in China who reported on the early outbreak of the coronavirus pandemic from Wuhan. A Chinese court handed down a four-year jail term on Monday to Zhang Zhan, who reported at the peak of the crisis in the city where the coronavirus first emerged. Her lawyer said Zhang was jailed on the grounds of picking quarrels and provoking trouble. The EU's diplomatic agency called for Zhang's immediate release, sourcing credible people that have said she has been subject to torture and ill treatment during her detention. The European External Action Service added, it is crucial that she receives adequate medical assistance. The U.S. State Department approved a potential sale of 3,000 precision-guided munitions to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It's a deal valued up to $290 billion, according to the Pentagon. The sale comes in the final days of President Trump's presidency, and President-elect Biden has pledged to handle things differently. He has said he would halt arms sales to Saudi Arabia, the Middle East's biggest buyer of American weapons, in a bid to pressure Riyadh to end a war in Yemen that has caused the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The Pentagon statement said the proposed sale will improve Saudi Arabia's ability to meet current and future threats. Despite approval by the State Department, the notification does not mean a contract has been signed or that negotiations have concluded. Russia state investigators said on Tuesday they have opened a new criminal case against Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. They have accused him of fraudulently spending public donations to organizations he controls on his personal needs. The move is likely to be seen as the latest sign that the Kremlin does not want the Putin critic, who is recovering in Germany, to return. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda warns South Sudan refugees to stay out of local politics.
Refugee youths who are in the urban center, particularly in Arua here, are being lured by their colleagues to join in the politics of this country. I want to warn the refugees, let them desist from that kind of behavior.
Security experts cast doubt on Nigerian official culpability claims about recent student kidnapping. Zambia's president received a preliminary police report on last week's killings at a police station. There are divergent views on the success of Zimbabwe's transitional stabilization program. And South Africa imposes new COVID-19 measures.
We want to decrease unsafe interactions between people. We want to decrease the burden on healthcare services so that resources can be directed to meet the needs of COVID-19 and other patients.
And the International Committee of the Red Cross reduces its activities in Central African Republic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudanese refugees living in Uganda's West Nile region have been warned against getting involved in Uganda's politics. This follows reports that some refugees have registered to vote in next month's election, while others have been seen campaigning for candidates in their host districts. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
As aliens, refugees in Uganda are not allowed to participate in politics, either by campaigning or voting. However, there are reports that some refugees have acquired national identification cards, which will be used in the 2021 general elections. Nahori Oya Awua is the resident city commissioner in Arua, in West Nile region.
The most disturbing thing is I'm receiving some rumors. The refugee youths who are in the urban center, particularly in Arua here, are being lured by their colleagues to join in the politics of this country, to go into procession, and all this unnecessary excitement because of the politics. They are now trying to either buy or lure these youths to join in the politics of this country. I want to warn the refugees that they are here for their own safety. This politics is meant for the nationals. Let them desist from that kind of behavior.
Nahori warns that the refugees found politicking will be prosecuted according to Ugandan laws.
When we shall get this information again, make sure you'll be arrested and charged. So the refugee leaders and organizations that are returned here who cater for their own people, please, you summon all your youths and tell them to stop meddling up the politics of this country.
Solomon Osakan is the West Nile region refugee desk officer. He says by participating in Uganda's politics, the refugees risk losing their status.
If we get someone who is a refugee and is registered as a refugee and is getting assistance as a refugee and is involved in politics, we deregister him. He ceases being a refugee. That is what the law provides. So that's why the commandants are there in the settlement to monitor, to check every day and to get reports and see that refugees are doing the correct thing.
Catherine Sikita, a representative of urban refugees in Arua City, confirms her fellow's involvement in Ugandan politics, which she quickly notes is illegal.
As a refugee, we are not supposed to be getting involved into political situations, like supporting any of the parties, directly going out for campaigns and wearing the T-shirts for any of these candidates that are aspiring. And if at all, out of excitement, the youth are getting themselves involved into politics, it's something that really they need to bring to an end.
Peter Lomure Anisi is a refugee leader in Rhino Camp Settlement. He has called for educating refugees regarding the law on political activity in Uganda. Refugees are not allowed to vote or to join political parties in the country.
Our children are now joining political parties in this country. It is not allowed at all. And other community leaders who are in our midst should emphasize this to their members. parents should also talk to their children. As the community, we are not ready to go and get somebody from police or mortuary.
Uganda is host to more than 1 million refugees, mostly from South Sudan. Uganda holds its national election January 14th. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
South Africa has been taken back to lockdown level 3 as the government battles the second wave of coronavirus infections being driven by a new variant. The new restrictions that have already kicked in have seen beaches and parks shut to the public. The sale of alcohol has been suspended while not wearing a mask now attracts a jail sentence. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The new COVID-19 variant driving the second wave of infections in South Africa has given the government and citizens no peace. More than 50,000 new infections have been recorded since Christmas Eve, forcing President Cyril Ramaphosa to impose new tough restrictions.
We want to decrease unsafe interactions between people. We want to decrease the burden on healthcare services so that resources can be directed to meet the needs of COVID-19 and other patients. These are the key reasons.
According to the new restrictions, all indoor and outdoor gatherings have been banned with the exception of funerals. A new curfew has been imposed from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. in the morning. Shops, restaurants, bars and cultural venues have been ordered to close their doors at 8 p.m. Not all South Africans agree with the new rules. Pumla Hamla is one of them.
I, for one, I don't see any need because it's affecting us, especially us who are having our businesses, like dealing with events and whatsoever, who are depending on them to feed us. It's really going to affect us.
Others like Tony Manyangadze are in support of the restrictions.
I think the move was rather too late. You should have done that way before Christmas, honestly, because the virus doesn't move on its own. It requires people to move it from one place to another. So sometimes I think we need to sacrifice a bit in order to gain a lot.
The sale of alcohol has been banned for both on-site and off-site consumption. The government argues that alcohol consumption leads to injuries that fill the scarce hospital beds. But the country's main opposition, Democratic Alliance Party leader John Steenhuisen, wants the government to concentrate more on purchasing the vaccine than crafting restrictions.
Hospitality industry, tourism industry, the liquor industry are all big employers in South Africa. Many people have poured their life savings into building these businesses up. And at the stroke of a pen last night, essentially, they were significantly curtailed.
Johannesburg and Pretoria are among 22 places that have been declared coronavirus hotspots. Barely a month after they were opened, beaches, recreational dams, lakes and public parks have been closed. Anyone found not wearing a mask in public could end up paying a fine or going to prison. The government has defended the restrictions, saying the infections were rapidly increasing and hospital beds quickly filling up. The total number of people infected so far has surpassed 1 million, while deaths are approaching the 27,000 mark. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zambian President Edgar Lungu has dismissed the country's Deputy Inspector General of Police Operations, Barney Kapeso. The president has also given the Inspector General of Police 6 months to transform the police and regain the public's confidence. President Lungu made the changes Tuesday after he received police preliminary report on last week's killing of two citizens near a police station. Nsama Chipioka, a lawyer of the National Prosecution Authority, and Joseph Kaunda, a supporter of opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema, were shot and killed at a police station. Presidential spokesperson Isaac Chipempe says President Lungu took no action because the report is inconclusive.
As we have said in the statement, it's a preliminary report, meaning that the report is not complete. So that's why the president decided to direct the IG to expedite the investigations it's too early to say anything. Obviously, the president is the only one who has had a look at the report for now, but it's not conclusive, as he has said.
What else does the president want from the police?
Obviously, the ultimate is to know the people behind the killing of the two individuals, and that is what is missing from the report. Everything else could be in the report, but it's not concluded because it doesn't state the people behind the killing.
Isaac, at the same time, the president is calling for changes to the police institution, including, for example, the appointment of a new deputy director general. So is this an admission of guilt?
No, as I put it, there's no clear people behind the killing. It's not clear who did it. And what the president is doing is to allow the new appointees to do their work and to ensure that the culprits are brought to book. So there is no admission of guilt because the report, as I said, has not mentioned whether it was police, whether it was other people behind the killing.
The opposition UPND has said that the invitation to Mr. Hakainde Hichilema to the police station was an attempt to just get him out of the way by implicating him so that he doesn't run against President Lungu in the 2021 election.
No, there is no such intention by the state. The elections, obviously, the president is the last one who would like anyone to be stopped from standing. It's a democracy. We're a democracy. And every individual who wants to stand for presidents will stand. The case has nothing to do with the forthcoming elections. It's a case that happened way back. And there's just information, maybe, which police have come up with. And they wanted to find out from him what he knew about the case in question. It has completely nothing to do with the elections, the forthcoming elections. So it's not true. No one wants to bar anyone from standing, except those who are guilty of offenses, obviously, are not allowed to stand according to the Zambian laws.
Isaac, thank you very much again. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and happy holidays to you and your family.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Isaac Chipampi is spokesperson for Zambian President Edgar Lungu. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lusaka. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 30th. Zimbabwe's three-year transitional stabilization program comes to an end this week, and a new economic blueprint is set to be implemented in the new year. There are divergent views on whether the TSP, as it is called, succeeded in turning around the economy and whether its successor will change anything. Reporter Kuzaya Musenge has more from Harare.
The government introduced the Transitional Stabilization Program, or TSP, in 2018 following President Emmerson Mnangagwa's election victory. It was intended to steady Zimbabwe's economy, which for several years had been characterized by unbridled government expenditure, huge budget deficits, hyperinflation, and currency instability. Mnangagwa has launched the five-year National Development Strategy, or NDS, to replace the TSP, which ends Thursday. Mnangagwa and members of his cabinet say the TSP put the economy on the right track. They point, among other things, to surpluses in the past two budget cycles, as well as the reintroduction of the local currency in June 2019, and its stability attributed to the introduction of a foreign currency exchange auction system. But critics say the budget surpluses have not improved most people's lives and that the local currency is overvalued, so an unofficial parallel market continues to operate. What's more, shortages of many goods continue and the inflation rate remains high. Economist Persistence Gwanyanya says the success of an economic plan should not be judged just on positive statistics like economic growth if there are no tangible benefits for ordinary people. He says while the budget surpluses can help the country get out of debt, most people see no immediate benefits from the TSP.
Our external debt is currently at around 8 billion, whilst the local debt is around, I think, 13 billion Zimbabwean dollars or so, which is not a so good position for the country. So the surplus that is being talked about is a management tool of getting out of the deeper hole. Second, it would appear it doesn't make sense that Treasury is insisting on surpluses when we are faced with such circumstances.
Peter Mtasa is the president of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions. He says the TSP failed because of how the government created it. He said the new economic program also will fail because there are several fundamentals that remain uncorrected, including rampant corruption and misgovernance.
There were no wide and effective consultations of stakeholders. Labor was not consulted. The citizens were not consulted. So they maintained their usual top-to-bottom approach, which has always led to lack of ownership and lack of democratic participation of citizens, as well as lack of accountability in terms of monitoring and evaluation, and also in terms of sticking to implementation matrices.
Danford Mutashu of the Confederation of Zimbabwe Retailers is among those saying the TSP has been successful. He says though Zimbabwe industry is not yet functioning as well as it did in the early years of independence, it is recovering. He also says that under the TSP, goods and services have become more available.
If you walk into any store right now, across the country, in the rural areas, you know, even in the impoverished areas, so there's no shop that is empty that you'll find without basics, without all other essentials and other critical goods. So that is a very good base that we've actually built.
Joseph Chuma, a member of the ruling ZANU-PF Central Committee, says criticism of the TSP and its successor comes mainly from naysayers who have never wanted to accept anything good the government accomplished.
Ever since the new dispensation came in, we have seen a lot of strides that are taking place towards the restoration of the economy. People are just not talking about it enough. But also, there is so much negativity, and our social media is not doing us any favor as well, because the people will always go out there and make it look like government is doing nothing at all.
Supporters of the TSP blame effects of the global coronavirus and international financial sanctions on some Zimbabwean leaders for the economy's weakness. The National Development Strategy will run through 2025. Reporting for VOA from Bulawayo, I am Kudzanai Musengi.
Nigerian security experts are casting doubt on the claim by authorities that tensions between farmers and cattle herders led to the recent wave of kidnappings in the northwestern state of Katsina. More than 300 schoolboys were abducted earlier this month, but later released. Timothy Obiesu reports from Abuja.
Authorities in Katsina initially blamed the mass abduction of 344 schoolboys on gangs of bandits who have kidnapped other people for ransom in the northwestern Nigerian state. Then officials reversed course, tying the abductions to cattle herders at odds with farmers about how to use the land. But retired police commissioner and security analyst Lawrence Alobi disagrees with the idea that herders carried out the attack.
The herdsmen, they don't have any problem with the school authority. They don't have a problem with the students. Their problem is between farmers, where they can graze their crops and graze their cattle. So I don't know the relationship between that abduction of those students and the farmers' clash.
Islamist militant group Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the abduction of the schoolboys and released the video footage showing some of the abducted boys before their release. The claim, if verified, would mark a turning point for the group, which to date has been active almost exclusively in the northeast of the country. Security expert Kabir Adamu says he believes the abductions were carried out by bandits acting on orders from Boko Haram sect leader Abubakar Shekau.
Call may have been placed at his direct direction. What is more important is who is behind, who are the authority, who makes the calls. So if the bandit group that carried out the attack have subjected themselves to the authority of Shekau, then it means he's the one who finally make the call.
Conflicts between cattle herders and crop farmers have lingered in Nigeria for many years, and thousands have been killed during violent clashes over grazing land. The Miyeti Allah Cattle Herders Association did not speak about the accusations from police, but the group played a role in negotiating the release of the schoolboys. Alobi says blaming farmers and herders' clashes for abductions may be downplaying or dismissing the possibility of expanding extremism in other regions of the country.
Government is trying to play on the psychology of the people to allay fear, but I think the government should say to the people, so everything be based on facts.
Nigerian authorities in 2016 declared that Boko Haram was technically defeated and recently refuted the group's claims over the kidnapping, describing it as whimpers from a dying horse. But security experts will be monitoring the situation closely to see what happens next. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
The International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, says it was forced to drastically reduce its humanitarian activities in Central African Republic after armed groups attacked its office in the town of Bua, Nana Mambiri province on December 27. Jason Strazuso, ICRC spokesperson in Geneva, says the attackers looted buildings and removed all equipment and supplies.
Unfortunately, the International Committee of the Red Cross had two security incidents in the Central African Republic, and what this has done is forced us to reduce our activities in one area of the country, and we're going to consequently increase our activities elsewhere in the country. But there is an increase in the insecurity situation connected to, we could say, the election activities that are taking place there right now. And unfortunately, we're seeing some attacks against our humanitarian presence, which is, of course, something we do not think should be taking place.
Your organization says that you have temporarily scaled down your humanitarian operations. And what does this mean?
When we say we're scaling down our humanitarian activities, what it means, first of all, on the level where we have to insist on keeping the men and women who work for us safe, it means that we're confronted with a situation where we can no longer ensure the safety of the team members on the ground because of the environment that they're operating in, because of these security incidents that we've seen, and therefore we have to pull back. Now, obviously, this means that without the men and women on the ground to carry out our activities, unfortunately, the consequence is that the activities that we're doing, whether we're helping people get fresh water or we're providing a medical care, we're providing food supplies and even agricultural supplies so people can grow food for themselves, these activities have to be put on hold until the safety situation returns to normal.
As you know, just saying, there's tension in the air in Central African Republic. First, the election and the conflict going on there between the rebels and government forces. Does the ICRC know who probably carried out the attack on your facilities?
Well, of course, our teams on the ground will connect with the people that they know and try to figure out who might have carried out these attacks. It's not a detail that I have, nor a detail that I could give you. But we would tap into our networks and find out what happened with the goal of making sure that it wouldn't happen again.
Can you describe for us the type of work that your organization is doing in Central African Republic?
One of our major activities in the Central African Republic is to assist with the healthcare system that's there. We're providing medicine and equipment to several hospitals in the country. In fact, just about a week ago, when there was new violence in the town of Bambari, our teams evacuated 15 wounded people to the local hospital for care. So that's some of the kind of work that we're doing. Outside of the medical work that we're doing, we're providing people with emergency food supplies, and we are reuniting separated families, families who may have been torn apart as they're fleeing some sort of conflict or violence. Our teams are also visiting people in detention and making sure that the conditions there are as good as they can be. And one of the other activities that we're doing in the Central African Republic is to increase people's access to water. because, of course, in this part of the world, the very basic item of water is not always available.
Jason Strazuso is spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross. He was speaking with us from Geneva. And that's it for this Wednesday, December 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good day.